The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Groundwater Statistics for Environmental Project Managers. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'll cover introductory material in the next few slides and then turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC team. As listed on the slide, today's training course is based on the ITRC online guidance document, Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance. We're going to introduce you to this document during today's training class, and we do hope that it's a resource that you can use in your work after today. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council. A few housekeeping items to cover as we get started. Today's course is 2.25 hours. We are recording the session, and we do offer archives of past training classes. The trainers control the slides today. If you want to control your own slides, you can download the presentation. And that's on that Clue-In training page where you started today. Near the top of the page, you'll see the PowerPoint icon. Throughout today's training, you are welcome to type in questions in the Q&A box. We're going to respond to some of those questions right away, get right back to you. For other questions, we'll hold those until the question and answer breaks. We're having one in the middle and another at the end of the training class. We'll ask questions out loud. Also, participants will have a chance at that point to ask questions out loud. Until then, we do ask that you leave your phone on mute so we don't pick up background noise. At the end of the class, we do ask that you fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information. We appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. It's also your opportunity to create a certificate of participation for yourself. You fill out the feedback form. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. Once you submit that, the system is going to create a certificate for you. If you forget to check the box, no problem. Just go back, check the box, and submit again. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators and includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full version of the ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of the slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. I do encourage you to visit the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of guidance documents available. We have our training schedule for the rest of this year available, as well as more information, including how you can become more involved in ITRC. I'll introduce the trainers for today's class. All of the trainers were members of the ITRC Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance team. That team was led by Ningwu Chang of the California Department of Toxic Substances Control. Harold Templin is a senior geologist at the Indiana Department of Environmental Management in Indianapolis. He has designed or improved groundwater monitoring systems, sampling and analysis plans, and statistical evaluation plans. Randall Wrighty is a senior scientist with Neptune & Company in Los Alamos, New Mexico. His work includes ecological and human health risk assessments supporting clients with groundwater over large spatial scales with multiple stressors, large and complex databases, and significant involvement of regulators, natural resource trustees, and the public. Liz Simmons is a principal geologist and technical practice leader for environmental site characterization for Kleinfelder in San Diego, California. Her extensive technical background includes numerous groundwater assessments, risk assessments, modeling, groundwater optimization, and litigation support. On slide 6, I'll now turn today's presentation over to Harold Templin at the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. Harold?
Okay. Thank you, Juliana. As we turn to slide 6, I would like to set the stage for using statistics to evaluate your groundwater data. And so let me just ask you this question. Are you drowning in your groundwater data from your site? You know, in my work at the state of Indiana, I have had mounds of groundwater data come across my desk, and people wonder, how do you know you're properly handling this data? How do you know that you're getting all that you need to out of it? And with that, I see the confusion that there is in using statistics to evaluate the data that you have. When you use statistics to evaluate groundwater data, it demands that you have adequate evidence of the data quality, sufficient amount of data, and proper data management. So let me ask you, are you drowning in your groundwater data? Are you wondering what data should I use? I have this mound of paper or electronic messages, and what data am I supposed to use? As well, I would wonder, well, where do I start? Do I look at all the information that comes from the laboratory? Do I just need to look at the numbers? What is it that I need to look at? And third, what is the data telling you? That's what we're trying to help you with today, is that you want to get the most out of the data that you have and understand what and have some confidence of what it's telling you. And do you make the best use of your data? Do you have enough data to make an adequate decision on the actions that you need to take? As you answer these questions, we'd like you to think about, can I use statistics to evaluate my data? Can a statistical approach help me to manage my groundwater data? You know, what we're doing today in this training is, if you're not a statistician, we see this will help you become a more informed consumer of statistics. It'll help you have confidence in spotting misapplication and mistakes. It'll help you review the selection of which statistical test should I use, which method should I use, and lastly, you help you understand the language that is used in statistics. Then if you are a statistician, we think that this training course will help you make your work and conclusions more understandable to the general audience. So this guidance is ITRC's solution to the groundwater monitoring evaluation. Using groundwater statistics for monitoring compliance and for the project lifecycle. The Groundwater Statistics and Monitoring Compliance web-based document, or short, let's just call it the GSMC document, will help you ask the right questions and direct you to the appropriate statistical method and maximize the value of your data. The ITRC first formed this team back in 2011 and brought together experts from different states and from the federal government agencies, Department of Defense, EPA, and Department of Energy. And along with them, brought in consultants and industrial people that deal with statistics on a daily basis. And this group came together and brought the information together in a usable and accessible web-based document. I want to point out that existing regulations differ widely, and as we saw in the poll, part of the people are required to use statistics, part of the people are not required to use statistics, and that from state to state you may have a difference in how the statistical practices are used. But still, the basic concepts of statistics, a statistical approach is useful and addressing or giving you confidence in what your data is telling you. In this first example that I want to bring up, we have these eight data points. The site has finished their active remediation, and they continue to monitor quarterly. And as you can see, a common situation in the groundwater is that it varies widely after the remediation is closed. And so now, how can you feel confident that you're making a wise decision, that you're building your decision on evidence, and that you have a statistical certainty of what's going on? What we want to show you in this is that, you know, that you may have a plan where you're to have two consecutive values below the standard, and as you're sure, that's what they have. But what certainty do you have in that sort of description? What we would suggest is looking at a statistical approach, understanding the distribution of the data that you have, you can get a confidence of where that mean should be, the middle point of the distribution. And using the upper confidence limit, a statistical method, you come up with the mean of 0.689 milligrams per liter, which, as you can see, is above the standard of 0.5 milligrams per liter. So what we will be doing in this class, Randall and Liz both will go into more detail about use this limit and understanding, giving you certainty of what your distribution is for a project of your data. In the next example, we're talking about managing the non-detect value, which seems to always be a concern. I tried to pick out a bad example, probably my worst example of a distribution of different non-detect values. As you can see here, the open squares are non-detect values, and we have them from almost 0.1 milligrams per liter down to just 0.001 milligrams per liter. So that their non-detect values over this long period of time has varied 100-fold. And so that you may wonder, well, what does this mean? You know, how can I manage this data? If you just use a simple substitute method, the mean is 0.0078 milligrams per liter with an upper confidence limit of 0.0125 milligrams per liter. But if we were to use a statistical method such as Kaplan-Meier, which takes into account the distribution of the data and the different non-detect values that you have, you then come up with a mean of 0.0022 milligrams per liter and an upper confidence limit of 0.0055 milligrams per liter. And in this case, what we're finding is that the upper confidence limit is below the criteria that we have set for this constituent. You can use this document in a number of different activities across your sites. You can use it to review and reviewing or using statistical calculations for a report, making recommendations or decisions based upon statistics, demonstrating compliance for the groundwater project. Building on your technical background and environmental experience in site compliance and cleanup, you can use this ITRC document even if you don't have a special expertise in statistics. And during this training, we're going to show you how. What we have here in this slide is basically the roadmap of how the training is going to play out. First, we want to show you how the GSMC document was created, how to use it, and then we'll get on into getting ready to apply statistics to your data, followed by a question and answer period, then going on into the study questions, discussing different questions and how they relate to different methods. Then I'll come back and we'll summarize and have another question and answer period. The GSMC document is a web-based document that allows you to move around throughout the document to follow your situation. The framework of the document is based upon the project lifecycle stages that you would go through. So as you go into the document, you may want to establish the team set up the document so that you go in at the different project life cycle stages so that the statistics, the groundwater statistical method, can be applied over the different project life cycle stages, as in release detection, site characterization, all the way down to closure. And they can support the decisions that you make in every one of these phases. The terminology and the framework for these project life cycles may vary in different regulatory programs, but to simplify it, the team selected these five stages. Next, the framework is developed around these different questions. So the team came up with these five questions that you might come up with in the different project life cycle stages. So if you were to click on, let's say, is there seasonality, it would go to that section of the document and it would discuss what seasonality would look like in your data and the possible different statistical methods that you would use so that it exists, or what to do to correct for the distortion of the distribution by the seasonality. And this seasonality, could be used during, as relevant in remediation stage, the monitoring stage, the closure stage. Next, what we have is from these study questions, then we have this bridge that we've made from the project life cycles over to the statistical approach that you might use. So that whether you're doing exploratory data analysis, which method you might be using, or which software you might want to use to conduct the method, they are all connected through the study questions to the different project lifecycle stages. With this set of understanding of the framework, let's look at how you might navigate through the document to assist you managing your groundwater data. So let's say that you're coming in at the different project life cycles. You're coming in at the detection phase of it, and you want to know what statistical methods you might use to see if there's been a release. Or you might ask the question, is there, you know, of how what is the medium value that there is in this release? And it'll take you over to the different software tools that you might use. And all of this is used to give you a better decision for your project. The guidance document was designed as a web-based document that can be accessed from very different perspectives. And so that you would come in at the welcome page and you might go to different sections of that and go to the different things that I've shown. The team tried to make this document user-friendly for the project manager, and there's many cross-references to the study questions, the methods, and then also to the Unified Guidance Document, EPA. This online document is not actually a textbook or such, but you can go then to the EPA guidance Unified Guidance, and it'll explain how the method is calculated, how to use that method, so that we feel like we've given you a balanced approach and a helpful guidance into using the Unified Guidance and to using statistics for your groundwater data. Another area that we've linked to is in the data quality objective process. This is a systematic planning tool based upon the scientific method to identify the types and quantity and quality of data that's needed to be used. And there's a link to the EPA's as well as other documents that describe how you might set up your data quality objectives. Then, as well, we have many other statistical references that are linked and help you out with your statistical issues. Okay, with that, I think we're ready to apply statistics, and I shall turn it over to Randall Reddy of Neptune & Company. Randall?
Yeah, thanks, Harold. So I want to first acknowledge Chris Stubbs of Ramble Environment. He's the one that actually put together these slides for this training, and I'm filling in for him and presenting them today. So with that, I guess if you're following along in your own package, we're on slide 19 now, going on to slide 20. So this part of the training is actually covering what are the main topics in Section 3 of the web-based guidance document. So if there's something that you want to see some more information on, you can go to that part of the document and read some more about it. And like Carol just said, there'll be some cross-references, other documents, where you can get some more information. But so what use is statistics anyway? So statistics is a science of drawing conclusions from data. And there's a number of ways that it helps you do this. One way that's very important we emphasize in this training is visualizing the data, so, you know, preparing plots of your data. And that helps you understand some of the trends in your data, where you have outliers, things like that, separating signal from noise, where you actually have real trends versus just random values occurring in your data set. Also, looking at what's happening over different scales. With groundwater in particular, usually we're interested in fairly wide-scale behavior of some, you know, contaminant or some process in the groundwater. Quantifying and helping to manage uncertainty, and this is a big part of then the last bullet, which is making better and more defensible decisions. If we don't understand what level of uncertainty we have in a value, then we can't really make a really informed decision. And so we're going to look at how these elements apply the statistical approach to groundwater data. Okay, well, we're going to start out with an example. And this example is actually based on a criminal trial you might have. And so in this case, we're looking at the crime was burglary, so property crime. Somebody at an environmental consulting office left the door unlocked, and some laptop computers were stolen. And so that's what happened. And there's a defendant identified. Mr. Ivan M. Shifty was identified as the defendant. So if we look at a jury trial in the U.S. system, what do we usually assume? We assume that the defendant is not guilty. And in the statistical hypothesis testing language, this is what we call the null hypothesis. So it's what we assume without having any other information. And what this also means is that you know, the burden of proof is on who declares, not who denies. And so in this case, the prosecutor would have to have proof that Mr. Shifty had actually committed this crime. And so what do? They present evidence. And evidence can provide a variety of different types. They might have fingerprints of this defendant at the scene. They might have in possession of the actual stolen laptops, things like that. And then the objective is then to prove guilt to a jury. In this case, it goes to the jury beyond a reasonable doubt. And so this is, if you think about this, this is going to be similar to what you're going to be doing, although not with a trial, with your groundwater data. And what do we want to do? We want to make sure we don't commit errors. So that's why the defendant is assumed not guilty. We're making, in essence, a policy decision about what's more important, what kind of error is more important to avoid for the defendant. So one type of error is innocent that goes to jail. So this is, in essence, what in hypothesis testing is called the false positive. And the other error is that he's guilty but goes free. It's a false negative. So the guilty person goes free. Okay, well, let's take this same thinking and look at this table here, which is showing the types of decision errors. So this is a decision error associated with a particular phase of the project life cycle, and as Harold just talked about, we've identified in the document various phases. Site characterization is, in essence, the first phase. So it's your entry into evaluating groundwater. So in this case, we're setting up the null hypothesis as the site groundwater is not contaminated. So that means that if you don't collect any data whatsoever, you're not going to identify any contaminants in groundwater. So then if we look at, you know, the options we have as the columns here, we have the columns in the table being, you know, the site is not contaminated. Here on the left, on the right, the site is contaminated. And so this is what we infer based on what we measure. And so really the only thing we know is we take a sample and we say, well, the site's either contaminated or it's not. Now, ideally we'd like to know what the true state of the site is, which are the rows here. First row is that it's not contaminated. So if the true site is, you know, there's the true state is not contaminated, and we get data that suggests it's not contaminated, well, we made a correct conclusion. That's good. And then what about the other true state of the site? Contaminated is a possibility. And if we conclude in this column, well, it's correct conclusion. We have data that says it's contaminated, and it was contaminated. So then the other off-diagonal cells in this table are the error. So the first error is the false positive. And unfortunately, in statistics, one of the problems entry level is we automatically start out with these alpha and the beta. So they're just, in essence, telling you what the probability is that you're going to make this kind of error. And again, it's a policy decision to set up the null hypothesis as site groundwater is not contaminated. It's also a policy decision to say, well, what probability do we want to have of allowing false positives? So in essence, in this case, you go out and you collect data. You infer the site's contaminated, which means you probably have to go back and do some other work. But in reality, it was not contaminated. So that's an error. And so that means that everybody's spending time and wasting effort tracing something that's not really contaminated. Okay, what about the other kind of error? So this is where the site's contaminated, but we collect data that, you know, we infer that it's not contaminated. So this is another kind of error. So basically there's some kind of environmental issue. There's contamination that we don't detect. So again, this is why, you know, these probabilities, this is a policy decision. What's the effect going to be on the public or the environment of allowing contaminated sites to go undetected? So it's actually pretty important stuff. Well, statistical decision-making. So when we're making decisions, as kind of alluding to there, you know, you need to be considering both types of errors. And then it's in essence, you have to come up with some policy decisions. You can use some guidance to say which kind of error is more important to avoid in this circumstance. You know, if you have sampling that's going on, and maybe you do some monitoring of groundwater, and later on you might catch the fact that there's contamination. And so what's happened is you missed some period when there's contamination, and that's not good, but that's not the worst type of error that might happen. But another type of error might be, well, you just never go back, and you never find that contamination until, you know, much, much later. And so that might be a bad, you know, scenario to happen. Okay, and then in terms of statistical significance, you know, this is the chance that we're going to have a false positive. Remember that table? That's the chance that we're going to have an error, you know, falsely declare that there is actually contamination when there's not. And so this is something that may be detected later, but you don't want to have a lot of work done at non-contaminated sites. So you wouldn't inherently want to be, you know, chasing, you know, no contamination. Well, how do you go about selecting the alpha level? You know, this is one thing where you can actually go into the, you know, the RCRA Unified Guide, and they have some discussion about how they set alpha level for that particular, you know, type of regulatory decision. But here are some other examples, you know, in medicine, you know, for PRAC, when you do a test and you might be testing for presence of, you know, a disease or a virus. And they do allow a fairly large number, say 1 in 20, 1 out of 20 people. So a large number of people in total, if you're testing a large number, might be, but that's in essence maybe the most, you know, the best you can do with that technology. You might like to have, like in physics, you know, a very small level of error, you know, in terms of false positives, but it depends upon, you know, the type of science you're doing and what kinds of measurements and what kind of things you can actually detect. And then the false negative error, and then this other related term, power of the test. So basically the chance of correctly classifying a site as contaminated when it really is. There's some things that we can do to manage basically this type of error. We can collect more samples. So one thing that's pretty simple to do is you can collect more samples, sample size, and also if you're saying, well, we're not so concerned about a small difference, if there's a little bit of contamination, it may not make a practical difference on human health or the environment. And these are policy decisions, as indicating. So it's important things to consider in terms of your monitoring network. And then the other thing that's done in lots of cases is to check the power. So basically, if I collect data and I identify it contaminated, then, well, I've basically made a positive call. But what if I don't find contamination? You might look at the power of the test after the fact to say, well, I didn't have a very good chance of detecting a contamination in this case. So, maybe I can't make a really good, strong inference that the site's not contaminated. Well, what are some of the, again, this is going to Section 3 of the web-based guidance document, what are the key aspects of a statistical approach? Well, the first thing that we like to emphasize is developing a conceptual site model. So conceptual site model, we'll give a little example here in a minute, but it's where you have identified what are the main aspects of the site, where groundwater is, what sources of contamination are, things like that, and oftentimes you do it graphically. Well, another thing that you might be doing is conducting data analysis. Now, this might seem a little bit strange. It depends upon where you are, in the project life cycle. Maybe you don't have any data, so you're really not doing exploratory data analysis in every case, but lots of times you're doing some statistical evaluations of a site, and there's some existing data, and so you'll want to do some exploratory data analysis as you're going through. Designing a statistical-based sampling plan, that's another thing that's important. So again, it depends on where you are in the project life cycle, how much data you have. So you can be using some information based on the conceptual site model and whatever you have in the exploratory data analysis to help you do that. And then you're evaluating your evidence and looking at what are your conclusions, what's the uncertainty in those conclusions. And then another important thing to do is check your assumptions. So, like I said, what is the level of the power of the test is an important thing to look at. Other things that are important, what's the distribution of the data? Does it follow a particular statistical distribution or not? Okay, well, conceptual site model can be written and or graphical expression of what we know about the site. And so here's a particular example. We're illustrating here a landfill, and we're showing on here various things. We're showing on here the direction of groundwater flow with these arrows, showing there's the site. We're showing locations of wells. And then there's also location here of sample collected in the river. And so what's being shown on here are some values of specific conductance. So this is basically a general water quality parameter indicator of the level of solids in the sample. And you can see the values in the river with tidal influence, meaning it's got a seawater mixing in with the fresh water. There's a fairly high value there, and this location here shows a high value. And some of these other locations show intermediate values relative to what's here upstream. So when we're looking at this kind of site and we're trying to figure out what's contaminants or not, we have to take into account the fact that this is where the site is located and it has these effects. It's got potentially the landfill might be affecting these down gradient wells, but there's also a river with some seawater effects on it too. So the question we might be asking about this site is, was the release from the landfill? And we could look at, for example, the specific conductance, and we could look at other, parameters and see, what we see in terms of what's elevated in what locations. And there's some different approaches. And if you look at, these two options here, we have one potential option is inter-well testing, meaning you're comparing multiple wells, so you're looking at basically an upgradient versus downgradient wells, and versus intra-well testing, which is looking at the results of one well over time. And if we look at the conceptual site model, you can look and say, well, one approach is probably better, and that's intra-well testing in this case might be better you know, if we're looking at things that are, conductance in particular, or things that are related to conductance. Okay, well, let's go on to the next topic, which is exploratory data analysis. So as I indicated already, one of the things we emphasize is, plotting your data, and we're going to go through and, describe, some of the plots, the type 5 plots that we like to use when we're looking at data and I think are useful in most circumstances. And so that's the, time series plots, box plots, which compare different groups. Scatter plots can look for associations. They're, in essence, a kind of time series plot. Histograms help you evaluate distributions. And then probability plots also look at distributions. And both histograms and probability plots can probably help you with outlier identification. Okay, well, here's just a simple time series, and this is showing a fairly long time trend in a particular example contaminant. We're just showing benzene and parts per billion concentration over about 20 years' time. Well, that's fine, but one important thing is whether or not the results are actually detected or not. And so Harold already gave kind of an example of this with his first calculation of the mean and confidence limit indicating, the detect versus non-detect. But as a good rule of thumb is if you have data sets that include detects and non-detects, which is pretty common for most groundwater constituents, that you, identify these with different symbols. Here we've shown it now the non-detects as these open symbols on this plot. And what you can pretty clearly see is that there are some different detection limits over time, and in fact, in general, looks like detection limits improve, and we only see detects in the last few events that are sampled in this well. So this is pretty important information, and you get a very different conclusion when you plot, when you show the the symbol for detect versus non-detect on the plot. So again, the conclusion from this is the detection limits are decreasing over time, and that's a nice conclusion, but it's nothing really about benzene contamination. Okay, well, box plots are a nice way to visualize different data sets, in particular, groups of data. In this case, we've shown, a pretty typical example where you might be looking at compliance, which would be downstream versus background, which are probably upstream locations of your site. And the nice thing about box plots is they actually take a large amount of data and they distill it down to some key information. And so here's what we have. The box plot is made up of different pieces. And so the first piece is this line in the middle here. You can't really see it on that one, but the line in the middle here in the compliance group, you can see that's going to be the median value. So half the values are above, half are below. And then the box is giving you a little bit of indication of the spread of the data. So it's the 25th percentile to the 75th percentile. So again, 25% of the values are below that value, 25 are above that. So it gives you kind of a nice idea of, in essence, of the distribution of the data and whether or not it's symmetric. You can look at that and say, yeah, that's pretty much spread out equally above and below. Now, these plots don't actually show whiskers in this particular form of box plot, but the circles are, in this case, the outliers. So there's a particular kind of box plot that'll identify flag outliers for you, based on, in essence, a normal distribution, which the data may or may not be normal. But in this case, you have a few outliers identified. You have a few more outliers in background than you have in the compliance set. The other thing you might see is that the spread of the data in the compliance set is a little bit wider than the background set. Well, scatter plots. So we've looked at, time series plots. And scatter plots are just a more generalized example, and it's just to help to show relationships between variables. We might have, in that case, the landfill. We might be looking at conductance and some other parameters we measure. In this case, we're just saying, well, we have a correlation relationship between arsenic and mercury. And so you can use one to kind of infer the other to some extent. And so that's what, these kinds of plots are useful for. Okay, well, what about, the next area is looking at, designing a statistical sampling plan. So, there's, as we discussed with the, hypothesis testing framework, you need the first setup, the false, the n- known alternative hypotheses. And then you're going to try to come up with a plan, you know, before you do sampling, that's an important point, to control or manage what the decision errors might be. Because there's with any kind of sample, you're going to have some potential for an error to occur. It's not going to be an entire census of the population of groundwater. That's pretty much impossible to do. So, and it's really important to understand what's the, you know, the power, in essence, the ability to detect a difference with the, you know, samples you've collected. And you can hypothetically come up with a curve and say, well, how much, you know, if I, the difference was this big, you know, between the groups, would I be able to have a good chance of detecting it or not? And you can do that before, and in particular after sampling, you can say, well, this is the power we think we have for detecting this kind of difference. And another really important thing is that actually changing your significance level does have an indirect effect on the power you're going to get. So if you change alpha, you will also necessarily change beta. But in essence, one thing you can do to always maybe do better at both is to have more samples. Or to say, I care about a bigger, this effect size means I care about a bigger difference between, you know, my site and background. I care about, you know, 20 parts per billion as opposed to one part per billion difference. So those are some of the trade-offs in terms of coming up with a design, and it's actually a pretty interesting process to go through that and try to figure out, well, what's the best way of balancing these trade-offs with a particular site of interest. Okay, well, now back to, you know, the evidence. So again, we're going to be doing hypothesis testing, and so we're in essence trying to do is the null hypothesis, you know, in essence are not guilty versus the alternative hypothesis guilty. So, you know, not contaminated versus contaminated, which one is true? Is there evidence to be able to reject? We have to have, then again, the burden of proof is to have evidence to reject the null hypothesis. And so the, you know, we talked about one, you know, way of stating the null hypothesis, do site concentrations exceed background? Another way of looking at it has, have cleanup goals been achieved? So in essence, the two are quite different. So our concentrations exceed background, null hypothesis might be, well, no, the concentrations are no different than background. We're looking for something that's greater than background. Have cleanup goals been achieved? We have a site that we know is contaminated, and we're trying to document that it's not contaminated anymore. So the null hypothesis is that it's contaminated in the case of cleanup goals being achieved. Trend in concentrations, that's also you just have to set up what is your null and what is your hypothesis in different cases. And it might vary based on where you are, you know, in the project life cycle. Okay, well, just to recap some of the steps in hypothesis testing, well, first of all, you have to define hypotheses, you know, what's the null and alternative. And obviously, you can tell, well, it's important to do this before I collect my data as opposed to after the fact, because then you might come to different conclusions based on you won't have enough data to reject the null. And so if you make the null, well, the site's contaminated, well, you don't reject that. So you have to be kind of careful about how you set up the null and alternative hypotheses. Well, then what you do is you'd say, okay, what's the value? So you have some sort of tests that you're going to run. And we're going to talk some about the kinds of tests you run for different kinds of examples later on in this training. But it's, you know, what's the result we get? And so it's we have a p-value that's associated with test statistic. So it's like if you're thinking about a two-sample test, you might have a student's t-test, and you calculate the value. It could be the z-score or the t-value. And you have, what's the probability if the null were true? And then you make a decision, you know, do you have enough information to reject the null hypothesis? So you set up null, you know, the alpha as being, well, maybe 1 in 100, 1 in 20. Is that value less than, you know, did you get value 0.1, which would be greater than 0.05 if you set that up in advance? And then if you don't reject the null, then you have to look at the power of the test. Did I have enough power to detect a difference if it occurred? Okay, well, what about, you know, there's a little bit about p-values. And so whether or not it's the test statistic, you know, like the t-value or the z-score, and then the related t-values are a measure of discrepancy between what you have and what you observe. And sometimes those values can be quite low. So in general, one can say that, you know, the lower the p-value, the greater the strength evidence against the null hypothesis. You might calculate a p-value that's, you know, 1 in 1,000 or less. But there are some caveats to that, so you need to be somewhat careful, because if you happen to collect a sample in a biased manner, you may have missed the contamination, and therefore, you know, you get really highly concordant data. You know, you don't reject, you know, the p-value's, you know, quite high, but it doesn't mean that you're really not contaminated. So you have to look at the data in terms of, again, what we said, the conceptual site model. So you have to have some information on the state of nature in order to really evaluate, you know, the test statistic and the p-values. Okay, what about uncertainty? Harold kind of talked about this a little bit, but, you know, a statement, you know, you say, well, here's the mean concentration, or you take the arithmetic average of your data set, and I get 5.1 milligrams per liter. Well, what does that, you know, what does that actually infer? So what question you might have is, well, how reliable is this estimate? You know, and that would get into, well, how many, you know, samples did I collect? And one of the things you can do with that is actually calculate what is called a statistical interval. And people have probably seen these a lot. You can have different software will, you know, put error bars on points, and they'll tell you, well, how much you know, confidence do I have in that value? You know, these are quite useful to look at, because they give you at least a graphical way, and then you can, you know, tabulate these as well and put them in a table and say, you know, it's 5.1, but the value might be between, you know, 2 and 20. And there's a variety of different intervals, and we'll talk some more about these in the later parts of the training too. But one thing that we have is a confidence interval. So this is the confidence interval in the actual mean. So you can have an upper and lower confidence limit on the mean. Prediction limits is another option, and tolerance limits. So the prediction limits are looking at, you know, what future values you might have. The tolerance limit is similar to the confidence limit, but it's going to be a confidence interval on a percentile as opposed to the mean. Okay, so, well, how do you, you know, come up with these? Basically, the confidence level, you know, you can see the term alpha in there. So if when you set up your hypothesis test and you set up your desired alpha, then basically you can, you know, make that equivalent to, well, here's the associated confidence limit in this mean value. So you would be setting this up alpha in advance of collecting your data, ideally. And then the idea is that, you know, if you have a sample, then you have, for example, there's going to be a range between, you know, 2 and 20, and that would be saying that, you know, that range includes 95% of the time we're going to have a mean within that value. That's quite a bit different than thinking, well, the mean is 5.1, because all of a sudden you gave the 5.1 an extra digit. And really, you know, you're not that confident in that value with statistical information that you have. Okay. So, and basically, confidence intervals can be used for almost anything you can think of on, you know, in statistical analysis of your data, whether it's the mean, the median, you know, slopes, things like that, even, you know, the intercepts on the y-axis. All those kind of things have confidence intervals associated with them. So prediction intervals, and so basically the confidence intervals are using the existing information you have. The big difference is prediction intervals, which are used quite a bit in groundwater data, is they're trying to give you an estimate of what's going to be happening if you collected some number of future samples. And you're inferring that based on the existing data, but you're going to make some inference about what might happen in the future. In some sense, it's kind of an extrapolation to the future of what you might be seeing. And the numbers are quite different, as you might expect. So if you look at a confidence interval on a data set, and here we just give a little example. You know, hypothetically, you'd have a data set with a range between about 9 and 13. And if you calculate the mean and then you calculate the confidence interval amount around that mean. That's what that mean is there, and then there's the confidence interval. That's what it is. It's fairly narrow, but if you look at the prediction interval on some number of future samples, in general, it'll be quite a bit wider than the confidence interval. And that kind of makes sense, is that you're looking at what's the possible value I'm going to have in either future value or future mean, given what I have information I know right now. Okay. How do you go about, selecting and testing hypotheses for, a couple different phases of the project life cycle? So we have release detection, site characterization. So this is also in the unified guide called detection monitoring. So basically, we're going to assume, the site is clean. So basically, it's not different than background. Or perhaps we're going to use an MCL to judge what's clean or not. But again, clean is really has to be defined specifically. What are you defining as clean? So then we set up our null and alternative hypothesis. And so for this example, we say, we're going to judge clean based on the MCL, maximum contaminant limit, for groundwater. And the null is that the mean is going to be less than the MCL. And then the alternative hypothesis is that the mean is greater than the MCL. And so then when we do the confidence interval test, so again, using the confidence intervals on the mean, we're going to say we're going to reject the null if the lower confidence limit is greater than the mean. So again, you remember that plot we just had, the lower confidence limit is that value below the mean. So it's that value below the mean has to be greater than the MCL. So now we're having pretty high confidence that the mean is actually greater than the MCL with that kind of hypothesis test. What about in corrective action or remediation? So in this case, we have already gone through and we have identified through other data. So we have data to know actually the site's contaminated. So we're going to have to now collect, new data that's going to show it's not contaminated, that we've taken some action or natural attenuation. Something has occurred such that the site's no longer contaminated. So we're setting up the hypothesis here. The null hypothesis is that the mean is greater than the MCL because that would be, in essence, the data we have. Alternate is now showing, now we have to show with data that the mean is now less than the MCL. And now in terms of the confidence interval test, now we're going to say we're only going to be confident that the site's not contaminated if the upper confidence limit is now less than the MCL. Okay, well, what about some other things we need to think about? So we talked about this, assumptions of your data. So this is, the results are only as good as the data that goes into the analysis. That's a pretty easy thing to understand. So here's just another example where we have, a data set in this case, again, a long time series of data for looking at benzene concentrations at a particular groundwater well. Now we've done what we're supposed to do, and we have identified on this plot the detects and non-detects, so the non-detects are these open circles. And you can see here there's one very large non-detect value at this particular well. So this value would have a pretty dramatic effect on the statistical, confidence intervals we might calculate on this well. And so we just need to decide what we want to do. And given it's a non-detect, it may carry very little weight, given that the only detects are much lower than that value. But this is something that would have to be discussed, and you'd have to come up with some rules as to how you handle outliers in your data set. Another thing that's important is understand the underlying distribution of your data set. And there's a variety of different statistical distributions that your data may follow. May not follow. So here we just gave a kind of a couple of examples and then showing a data set with histogram and with a normal probability plot, which are also sometimes referred to as QQ plots, basically the same thing. So first, the histogram, people are familiar with seeing this lots of times, so just the counts in various bins. So you take your data set and bin it into different concentration bins, and then just the number. Frequency means the count. The count of values in here. And you can see this kind of looks kind of spotty, but when you look at histograms with relatively small data sets, it's not too uncommon to see things where it doesn't look bell-shaped. But ideally here, if it was normally distributed, you'd see a bell-shaped distribution. And you can use those plots to identify distribution and also look for outliers on there too. So another thing you can do that's a little bit more diagnostic, you might say, is these normal probability plots. And you can also take data sets and you can say, well, you know, log normal means you just take your concentration and you take a log of it. In this case, it's a log of a data set. And we're just saying, what's the, does it follow a straight line? And so the straight line would be a normal distribution, either if it's a normal or log normal. And, if you have a particular distribution that you can, assign to the data set, then you can use what are called the parametric. It means just those methods, assume a distribution. And there's benefits to having greater power if you can use a parametric method. So those are preferred to a non-parametric method. And those are generally just using the ranks of the data. So when you take the data set and you rank it, then those always kind of follow a uniform distribution. You can imagine that, the values could be quite skewed. You have a really high value, but that's still just rank one. And then the next number down is rank two. And so that's why those methods can be applied in almost any circumstance. Okay, what about some other things that are, good caveats to look out for? So independence. So this is something that's pretty important in terms of statistical analyses of the data. If you have a data set and you sample, basically every hour at a groundwater well, you can imagine you're going to pretty much get the same value. Then if you waited 2 or 3 years and collected a sample, well, now that new sample is probably pretty independent, but you have kind of missed the gap in terms of any kind of time trends in that location. And so there's some conventions, and we talk about this later on about, sampling frequency in terms of designing and optimizing, collection of samples. But the rule is, don't sample, too often. Another thing that happens in any, kind of sampling program, environmental sampling program, is you collect replicates or duplicates. And that's to say, basically, if you sample the, the same well and you collect another sample right after, that's usually considered to be replicate analysis, and you have to come up with some rule beforehand, again, to how you handle those, because those are basically not independent samples, and so you shouldn't just put those into the analyses without doing something about them first. You can, a couple things you can do. You can either average them, or you can just take, in essence, the first value and remove the other one. Another thing we're going to go through later on also, background stability, trends in background data set really have a pretty big impact on the ability to use a variety of statistical methods. So it's something to be aware of, and oftentimes, background values aren't stable. They, in essence, have trends, whether they're seasonal trends or some other more long-term trends. And it's just an example showing, well, here's a plot of toluene parts per billion over multiple sampling events. And you can even see if these sampling events are quarterly, you can actually even see, potentially some, trends within a year as well. So there's various things that would happen if you're doing it. But we'll just go over this in some more detail later on. But that's something to look out for. Okay, well, what about, to wrap this part up, what are some of the main thoughts? So already talked about this a few times, but the most important thing to do is really to plot your data. If you have some data, and we showed you some examples of some plots you can use, and we'll have some other examples of those, that's a pretty important thing to do. And then the next thing is, once you've looked at your data, do you have enough to make a good decision, with whatever error rates that you specified? And if you have, or if you're doing a data analysis without, pre-specified error rates, then that's probably not a good thing to do. It's just not quite as defensible as some other, approaches of just confirming, doing what's, setting this up in advance. Another important thing is there are different, areas have different requirements. You set up, in essence, I said it's kind of a policy decision, what you use as null and alternates in some cases. There's some that are more logical than others, but they're policy decisions about, what is the null and alternative hypothesis, and what the error rates should be. And you know, something else, you know, we said that when you're, you know, starting out, you have a conceptual site model. So that's what we mean. You know, you have other information about your site besides just the raw numbers. And, you know, you just don't have a pile of data like was on Harold's desk. You have information about the site and where contamination is expected, what kinds of things are expected or not. So you need to use the statistical analyses in conjunction with other lines of evidence. Anyway, and lastly, if you just keep looking for things, you might find something. So what this means, if you just keep looking for a trend or, you know, keep subsetting or removing outliers, then something might show up. So you need to be pretty careful about when you're coming up with your statistical analysis plan to identify the steps you're going to take in advance, begin with the sampling design and also whatever analysis plan you're planning. And we've done that in some projects, and it's much more effective than just having some open-ended evaluation of your data. So I think with that, we're going to now have a short question and answer break.
Thank you, Randall. Everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. If you're on the phone line, you can unmute #6 to ask questions out loud. Before we get to those questions, I do want to remind you that we have a feedback form at the end of today's training class. We would really appreciate it if you take just a few minutes at the end of the training class to give us your feedback. The feedback form is also how you can create a certificate of participation for yourself. Right now, the only way to get that certificate is by completing the feedback form. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended, and the system is going to create a certificate for you. Also, during this question and answer break, we have a poll question for you in the lower left. Select the areas where you use statistics on your projects, and these are the areas that we're going to cover in the second half of today's training class. A few questions have come in online. At slide 30 with the box plots, what software was used to plot this data? Also, what statistical software is recommended from this training?
Okay, well, that's a great question about software. Unfortunately, Chris put these slides together. I'm not sure which software he used for those particular plots. But, we do have, and we'll talk about this actually some more at the end, but one of the nice things about the web-based guidance document is we have, a review of software that was available at the time and that we had information had been used in groundwater statistical analyses. And it gives you kind of a nice, quick and dirty look at what kinds of software can make different kinds of plots. And so there, for in terms of box plots, I know even, there's some macros and some, spreadsheets that can, create those plots, because if you think about it, it's not that complicated to plot a line on the 25th and 75th percentile in the median. Calculation outliers also can be automated. So, there's a variety of different tools. We don't recommend in particular one over another, but you can judge for yourself on what's available, and we also have some information on the costs. Some of these packages are actually available for download.
Do parametric methods continue to be defensible, or are non-parametric methods preferred now?
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't say that one or the other is really, in or out of favor. I think that you can certainly kind of, again, it gets to somewhat of a, policy decision. It's, if you look at what tools you'd like to use, you might have a preference for something that's a little more straightforward, in which case you might want to assume non-parametric, because that's pretty simple. Basically, you can always run the non-parametric. To run the parametric test, you do have to check for your assumptions about the distribution. So I would say that there isn't one that's preferred or not. I think you have to come up with, your objectives for your project and design it accordingly.
Can you give us an example of working through the design of a statistical sampling plan?
I could, but it's somewhat time-consuming, just process you go through. But in essence, what you would be doing is, like we had in the case of just our simple examples, and you're just saying, well, what are we trying to do? Are we trying to detect a release? And you might say, well, I need to then have samples at locations to identify background and what we call compliance, so basically up and downstream. And then that kind of gives a framework for, you know, this is, you know, where we might be sampling. But you need to have, you know, that conceptual site model. You need to have an identification of, you know, do we need to worry about, in that case we had the tidal influence, you know, that effect, because we're worried about things that are correlated to, you know, solids, you know, conductance. So it's a little, it's, you know, we can, and I think that's one case where Harold said that there's some other resources available. You know, people are interested in that aspect of it. I definitely encourage you to, you know, get into the web-based guidance document and start looking at some of those other references, because we do have some where they do work through some examples. You know, it's a little too involved to go through it here right now in the Q&A.
For groundwater sampling, how often is too often?
Yeah, I don't want to punt that one entirely till later, but, yeah, we do talk about that component of redundancy a little bit later. But, you know, in general, what people have come up with as a rule of thumb, as you know, a lot of groundwater samples are collected quarterly. Now, they can be collected in different intervals as well, but that's, in essence, part of the design. You have to come up with, based on what we know about the conceptual site model, what's reasonable in terms of, you know, what's going to be fairly independent. And even after you collect the samples, then you need to see, you know, are these truly independent or not? You may find out that they're not. But, you know, that's kind of the process you have to go through, is you have to first start with your conceptual site model, you know, and that then have some existing data and then look for, you know, whether or not it looks like these samples, you know, collected quarterly or independent or not. So that's, you know, in general, most people start out with quarterly and then they might go with some other intervals from there. But, you know, again, that's kind of more site-specific decision, is what do you want to do.
Can you use null hypothesis testing to show that remediation has reached asymptotic conditions? If so, do you have any examples?
Well, yeah, I think that's going to be a pretty common thing in terms of, you know, when you look at natural attenuation in particular as a method or some other methods. Basically, you know, that's, again, where if you're setting up a null hypothesis, you have to document something as below a level, so you're looking at your upper limit as below some target. That could be difficult to attain. In that case, you may switch and you say, well, you can try that hypothesis, and then you might, you know, switch the hypothesis to something else. What you're saying is really, you know, is the level of change now reaching some kind of steady state? And the level between, you know, last year and this year, we're showing a, you know, it's a decrease, but it's, you know, it's never going to get to zero. So it all depends on where you are relative to the MCL. I don't have one off the top of my head where, you know, where we did that, but that's something that you would look at in terms of, you know, a time series and a trend analysis. You might, you know, set up a hypothesis, recognizing that you may or may not, you know, be able to attain an MCL. And you could look at some alternate values too, but, you know, that's one of the complications, I think, in groundwater in particular. When you're sampling, you have a site that's contaminated and just showing, you know, finally later on that it's, you know, met a standard, because, you know, things can happen. There can be rebound effects if you stop, you know, pump and treat. So, you know, groundwater in that sense is more complicated with, you know, when you're trying to document, you know, statistically that you've attained a level. You know, and that's when you basically work on, you rework your objectives and say, is there something else that we can obtain? We can't really clearly show this one, but we might be able to show an alternate way of showing, yeah, we've really attained, you know, compliance. We've done as well as we can do in terms of cleaning up the groundwater.
What is the best method for handling non-detect data with changing detection limits over time? More specifically, what is the best way to incorporate the data to obtain a Thielson trend?
Okay. Yeah, so, yeah, I think that some of the methods, yeah, I guess you'd have to look at Kaplan-Meier probably as a method for, you know, handling the non-detects. Yeah, it depends upon how radically different the detection limits are. This is a case where potentially you could set up, if you know this is going to be an issue for your site, you could set up an advanced kind of insensitivity. You know, there are simple ways of doing it. You can, you can replace values with a particular, range of values, and you can see what the effect is. And at some level, when you have a level of sense, if the data is mainly non-detect, then your conclusions are kind of mainly non-detect conclusions. So I really can't. It's hard to answer the question in general. You'd have to look at the data set and see, what the level of non-detect would be, to understand what the best methods might be. But, the Kaplan-Meier is used quite a bit as a fairly robust replacement method, for non-detects, and you can apply that to most any of the methods. And I think we do have some discussion about that if you go and look up that particular method in the web-based guidance document, you'll find some information on it.
Thank you. We're out of time for this question and answer break. Please continue to send in questions in the second half of the training. In some cases, the trainers are going to respond online. In other cases, we'll try to get to those during a second question and answer break at the end of today's training. A reminder, if you do leave before we wrap up, we do want your feedback. So in the middle right, those related URLs, the second one down, select the feedback form, look down a bit, select that Browse To button. That's going to open the feedback form for you, and we do appreciate you giving us your feedback before you wrap up today. Looking at our poll question results, this is similar to what we've seen in the past, that quite a few people are using statistics for background compliance and trend analysis. And monitoring optimization is something new that we're going to introduce to many people during today's training class. So thank you for filling out that poll question. We'll continue on of the training, and I'm going to turn it over to Liz Simmons at Kleinfelder. Liz?
Thanks, Juliana. We're now going to present some different examples of the application of statistics to various groundwater sites. So in the next couple of sections, we're going to go through some study question applications and use Project Lifecycle to highlight the concepts and statistical methods that Harold and Randall just presented. And these could apply to some typical questions that might be asked. Now, because of the time involved, we're not going to be able to cover all the questions in this training, but we'll kind of give you a flavor of what's in the guidance document. And if you want to get into further discussions of all the study questions, they're found in Appendix C in the guidance document. Since groundwater statistical methods have applications throughout the life cycle of environmental projects, we're going to use the life cycle stages and study questions to illustrate the connections of some hypothetical sites. And these questions were developed by the team to easily navigate through some typical issues and questions that may come up during various phases associated with groundwater monitoring, and also ways to evaluate the data. Now, in the table at the left, we show the project lifecycle stages, this time as columns, and the study questions are listed on the right. And the study questions that generally apply to each of the lifecycle stages are noted with the X's in the table on the left. Now, in the guidance document, this is the main tool we use to connect between life cycle stages and study questions, and it's used to help the reader find information that can be relevant to their particular site. The first question or concept that we're going to discuss is background. And for background, study questions 1 and 2 are applicable. For study question 1, what are background concentrations? This one applies to life cycle stages for release detection, site characterization, and closure. For study question 2, are concentrations above background applies to release detection, site characterization, monitoring, and closure. So, what is background? Sometimes the concept of background can vary from state to state. But what we're talking about here is site-related versus not site-related. In general, both native and man-made sources need to be taken into account. However, a baseline has to be established first, because groundwater may already be tainted with concentrations of a contaminant from either native or man-made sources that would make it difficult, if not impossible, to clean up to what may be considered a pristine standard. And the web-based guidance document addresses this in more detail as well. Background's usually tied to some sort of a regulatory threshold, whether it's a criterion like a MCL, maximum contaminant limit, a risk-based criterion, or some other threshold. Also, background information is published in literature, and this may also be helpful to kind of do a desktop study on this. Back on slide 31, Randall discussed intra-well versus inter-well. And consider this as a time-only relationship versus a time-space relationship. For intra-well samples, you're sampling the same well many times, so you're looking at, and essentially before, if possible, a during and after contamination picture. And need to be aware that natural factors typically don't affect intra-well samples, only what happens over time. For inter-well samples, you're comparing different wells. Generally, you're comparing what you're considering as an upgradient or background wells with downgradient compliance wells. So here you're evaluating samples over time and space. So when we're evaluating background, what do we need to consider? First, we need to know what the known sources are and how many sources there are. And these are sources that are not related to site contamination. Need to know the distribution and direction, the geology and the hydrogeology information. And here we use it to estimate groundwater gradient, fracture flow, evaluation of intra-well versus inter-well data. Also need to look at multiple aquifer characteristics. For example, is there a perch zone, multiple aquifers? And if so, you're not going to want to cross-contaminate, so you need to be aware of these characteristics. Data quality objectives. These should be developed up front, and you also need sufficient samples to provide reliable results. And you need to look at the quality of your data set. For example, we just talked about this in questions. Do you have multiple detection limits? Basically, you need to develop a good conceptual site model to maximize the validity of your assumptions. As Randall talked about in the previous segment, we should use exploratory data analyses methods to help evaluate a potential background data set. And if you've got your guidance document, this is discussed in detail in sections 3.3.3 and 3.5. An initial step would simply to be inspect the data to determine the frequency of detection, representativeness of the samples, whether there are one or multiple detection limits, the time span of the data. Can some data be too old? Some sites you have data that run 20, 30 years down the line. And also the consistency of analytical methods. For example, if you're looking at BTECs, you could be looking at methods 80-20, 80-21, 82-60. So you need to look at all of that. And to get a quick visual, you can use graphical methods such as histograms, quartile plots, box plots, or scatter plots to plot the data set so that you can get some insight into the overall spread and potential distribution of the data. You also need to determine the distribution of the data set to figure out whether it's parametric, for example, whether it's normal or log normal, or non-parametric, where it doesn't necessarily fit the normal distribution or you might not have enough samples. And also which statistical methods will be needed in your evaluation of background. For example, if you're looking at outliers, a t-test, which is a parametric test, is sensitive to outliers. Most regulatory governance, for example, if you're looking at RCRA, it requires the establishment of background. And this example shows how potential background well data can be evaluated to determine whether a data set can be used to characterize background. This example applies to study question one, what are background concentrations, and also study question two, are the concentrations greater than background concentrations? For study question one, we're going to use descriptive statistics, and we'll use inferential hypotheses in study question two. This example shows a hypothetical metal recycling site and arsenic is the primary chemical of concern, and a groundwater plume has been characterized. For this site, the conceptual site model's already been completed and validated, the hydrogeology's been studied, and based on the hydrogeology, these are the upgradient wells, which are wells 1 and 2, that are in red, the side gradient wells, which are wells 7 and 8, and the down gradient wells, which are wells 3 through 6. And this is all based on the conceptual site model. So this is our hypothetical site here. So what I've got up here is I've got the data set, and the objective is to identify a data set that would be consistent with background. And so we first selected this potential data set, and then we evaluate the quality, the shape, and the distribution of that data set. What are our data quality objectives? How do they apply to the number of samples that are required? Are there any non-detects that must be addressed? And does the data have a stable mean and variance? Are there trends? Are there outliers? What are the distribution? These are the things that we need to look at when we look at a data set, not just the numbers. And here we selected the data set for the two hydrogeologically upgradient wells over a two-year period. And for our purposes, this should give us a sufficient number of samples to meet our data quality objectives. In this particular data set, you'll notice that there's no non-detects, and both upgradient wells are also below the MCL. There's a number of methods and tools to do preliminary statistical analyses. For example, you can use probability plots or you can use time series plots. And for interpretation of the results, you need to understand the source of whatever variation you have, whether it's natural or man-made, take a look at the environmental settings. You can get information from researched or published studies. You need to look at temporal changes. Is it a rainy season versus a dry season? And you also need to identify the presence of outliers. So, you know, here we've, you know, kind of done this for the particular data set that we had for these two wells. And then as we look at it, you know, based on the analysis and interpretation, does our conceptual site model need to be revised? And just remember, conceptual site models are living documents. And if there appears to be another upgradient source, update your conceptual site model. It's really that easy. In this case, based on the graphical methods we used, well W1 appears to be fairly consistent with that expected for a background well, where W2 has a couple of points or outliers that may be called into question. Upon further research, those two points both occur in April when there's a larger runoff from the mountains where there's higher arsenic concentrations in the rocks, because that's what we're looking at. We're looking at arsenic. And therefore, both these can be considered as background wells. Now, more often, a specific reason for the outliers isn't known, and this is where statistical methods come in handy in being able to manage the outlier data. Okay, next we're going to discuss how statistics apply to monitoring compliance. And these apply to study questions 3 and 4, and for study question 3, are the concentrations above or below a criterion, applies to life cycle stages for release detection, site characterization, remediation, monitoring, and closure. And for study question 4, when will the criterion be met, applies to project life cycle stages for remediation, monitoring, and closure. You know, because we have a time constraint here, we're not going to be able to go through study question 4, but it is addressed within the guidance document. So why do we do monitoring and evaluate compliance? First, to evaluate site characteristics. And site characteristics can be evaluated based on a combination of both spatial and temporal data. And we also use it to evaluate chemical concentrations for to see if they're in compliance with groundwater protection criteria. The purpose of monitoring design is to first evaluate chemicals. What are your potential contaminants and how have they changed over time? For example, you know, you can take a look at chlorinated hydrocarbons, where you can get the whole range from PCE to TCE down to vinyl chloride. So where are you at? Also for identifying a release, you can use your monitoring design for developing a conceptual site model and confirming it, and also so that you can be in compliance with regulatory requirements. Groundwater criteria compliance can be based on an MCL, background concentrations, a risk-based value, which is based on some sort of an exposure scenario, or an ecological protection value. And compliance measures should be presented in your quality assurance project plan, which should include the number of samples, the distribution, whether it's parametric, you know, normal, log normal versus non-parametric, where it doesn't fit the normal distribution or there may not be enough samples, identify a regulatory threshold, and these can vary depending on what compliance criteria you're addressing, and also a compliance point. And this can be a number, a maximum limit, or some sort of a set value. Now we're looking back here at our hypothetical recycling facility again. And for a monitoring compliance example, we're going to focus on study question 3, are concentrations above or below a criterion? So we've already determined that wells 1 and 2 are background wells and are upgradient. And based on our conceptual site model, wells 7 and 8 to the side are side gradient and outside the plume. So for this question, we're going to focus on wells W3, W4, W5, and W6, which are within the plume and or, you know, down gradient of the suspected source. Here's our data set for wells W3 through W6. It's got the same number of samples and date ranges as we saw for wells W1 and W2, and it meets our data quality objectives. There's no non-detect in this data set because it's metals. And note also that the data set presented above mimics the actual laboratory data set, where higher concentrations tend to have fewer significant figures based on the threshold detection limits. Also based on our conceptual site model, W3 is closest to the source. W3 is at your left there. And W4 is farthest down gradient, which is farthest to your right. So basically, as we're looking at it, W3 is the closest, W6 is the next closest, W5, and W4 is the farthest. So it goes from left to right. So we're going to take a look at wells W3 and W6 first of all, and those are in the orange and yellow. And if you look at these, the first thing you may notice is that the samples from W3 are about 6 to 9 times the MCL. Samples from W6 are about twice the MCL, but there's less variation in the data than you see in well W3. Okay, we're now going to move on to the data in wells W4 and W5. And once again, these are in the yellow and orange. And if you notice, samples from W4 are all below the MCL and are fairly consistent, while samples from W5 straddle both sides of the MCL and have a slightly larger spread. For W3, W4, and W6, you may not need statistics, and that may be true, but it's also a misconception. And there's also always uncertainty in the results. And the real usefulness here is in the sample results from W5, which is, you know, as you look at it, it's definitely the harder case. Randall previously discussed data distributions and confidence intervals in his segment. And as we're evaluating data for the four wells in our example, we need to look at confidence intervals. And as I said, Randall discussed these previously, and they're discussed in detail in the guidance document. Now, there's many kinds of confidence intervals, but they tend to bind a single population. And the mean or the average is a typical confidence measure. And the mean is shown here as the horizontal colored lines for the various well sample sets. For example, the mean for the W6 sample set is in green. Is it the green line? And the mean for the W4 sample set is the blue line. The mean is based on multiple observations so that a decision can be made with statistical confidence. For example, one point doesn't prove the mean or max is below a certain concentration or criterion, and one point above it doesn't violate that criterion. The vertical black arrows show the confidence interval on the mean for the different well sample sets. For example, the variability of the confidence interval for the W3 sample set, which is in green, is greater than that for the W4 sample set, which is in blue. And confidence intervals can also be measured around other things, such as an upper percentile or median. And percentiles can vary too, depending on your risk tolerance. But the 90, 95, or 99 are typical values that we use when we do statistics. The number of samples required to calculate confidence intervals from your site should be based on data quality objectives. And there should be a sufficient number of samples to compensate for whatever kind of variability you have in your data, for uncertainty, for false negatives, and for false positives. Now, this particular site happens to be in the state of Washington. And since it's in Washington, we've got to use the guidance that's been designed by the state. And it should be noted that this is one method, and it doesn't match up with what's in the unified guidance, but this is what the state's chosen. In the guidance document, we talk about regulatory barriers for various states. And Harold's also mentioned this previously during his portion of the discussion. So after we go through the state of Washington state guidance, we'll do this example as a reference site that uses the unified guidance. So these two examples are given to illustrate how results of statistical analyses are used and that they're used in different ways by different regulatory agencies. So if we're looking at clean, it'll most likely be based on a state-prescribed basis that may or may not be statistically based. So in this example, the data from the wells were evaluated using the State of Washington compliance test, which starts out with a comparison of the 95% UCL. So let's take a look at the three criteria used for the Washington guidance. The first one is the upper 95% confidence interval on the mean less than the cleanup standard. So if we look at the various wells, that answer is no for wells W3, W6, and W5, and it's yes for well W4. The second criteria is the maximum data point value less than 2 times the cleanup standard, which is 10, and that is no for 3, no for 6, yes for 5, and yes for 4. And finally, our 10% of the data above the cleanup standard. And that is yes for wells W3, 6, and 5, and no for well W4. So if we're looking at this, wells W3, 6, and 5 are not in compliance with the State of Washington guidance, and well W4 is in compliance with the State of Washington guidance. So the main question here is, if concentrations remain above a groundwater protection criterion, then when will the site be in compliance? And that goes into question 4. So let's kind of follow this through as a recrocite. And as referenced in our guidance document, when looking at the recro situation, which is based on 40 CFR 264.99, the US EPA's unified guidance document is typically used. So let's take a look at the same site based on that guidance. As Randall described earlier, from a release detection point of view, the MCL represents an average concentration, and the appropriate statistical test is a null hypothesis with the mean less than the groundwater protection criteria, where the mean is assumed to represent the true mean. We conclude that a well is in compliance when the lower confidence limit of the mean is less than the groundwater protection criterion. In other words, because we don't know what the true mean is, we assume that it could be any value within the confidence interval that we've calculated. So even though the mean might be greater than the groundwater protection criterion, we're not out of compliance until the lower confidence limit is also greater than the mean. In the table above, we calculated the 95% confidence interval for the mean of the concentrations for each well under the assumption that the data were normally distributed. To establish, you know, or evaluate your distribution, you may also want to use some distributional tests, and look at the assumptions in your test. We then compared the lower confidence limit to the arsenic MCL of 10. And when the lower confidence limit was greater than the MCL, we concluded that we're out of compliance, and vice versa when the lower confidence limit was less than the MCL. So in this example, wells W3 and W6 are out of compliance, and wells W4 and W5 are both in compliance. Now, this assumption we looked at from a release detection perspective, and as such, the null hypothesis is that the well is in compliance. If the groundwater protection criterion falls below the upper confidence limit, then the null hypothesis will not be rejected unless the groundwater protection criterion is also below the lower confidence limit. And this is just to be sure that background exceedances don't predetermine any relationship of those increase versus the groundwater protection criterion. For remediation or corrective action, on the other hand, the null hypothesis is actually reversed. So again, this demonstrates the difference between various regulatory frameworks. And I'm now going to turn the presentation back over to Randall Wrighty for discussion of trend analysis. Randall?
Yeah, thanks, Liz. So we're going to cover a couple of the topical areas here. So the first one's going to be on trend analysis. We're on slide 65 if you happen to be following along in your own PowerPoint or PDF. So, getting into the Okay, there we go. So again, we have identified study questions that relate to these different areas. And so we have on this slide, we're showing four questions are related to trend analyses. I'll note that question eight is actually a spatial question, and we're not going to cover that in this training. But if you're interested in that one, please see section 5.15 in the web-based guidance document to get more information. We are going to cover the other ones. Is there a trend? Is there seasonality? And look at the how you evaluate the attenuation rates and wells. Okay, well, again, so we're going to emphasize this again. So plotting your data. So in this case, we have symbols, and they're all open symbols, and they happen to be all detected values in this particular example. This example is actually adapted from the EPA Unified Guide. So if you look at this, you can see, yeah, there's some information here. You can look at the values going up and down. But, you know, whether or not there's a trend or not is not really clear. So the advantage of doing formal statistical analyses, in this case we just did a linear regression, it shows you the overall trend in these values over this, about a three-year period of time. So we can see that the values are increasing. So that's an important thing. So the trend analyses basically gives you information on the direction of the trend, you know, the direction of the change, and also what is the rate of change over time. And it can give you information on whether or not, you know, and cyclical things too, like seasonal effects. Where are some various applications of applying trend analysis? So based on the survey, a lot of people do this already. I'll note that if this is something that you're pretty familiar with and just are interested in checking, you know, your assumptions about different methods, this is where a really good example of a web-based guidance dog. And we can go right to a particular type of trend analysis, and you can look for the assumptions in that section of the document. Or if you're just trying to explain to a colleague, you know, what something, you know, the definition of something, you can find definitions. So it's pretty useful to people that are, you know, if you're familiar with something, or if you're just a novice, you want to learn more about it. So exploratory data analysis, you know, we talked about this already, the question about background levels being stable or not. So if we think about, in particular, like an intro well example, if we have levels that are changing over time just due to natural conditions, then we can come to some incorrect conclusions about whether or not there's release. You know, if you think about, well, maybe concentrations are kind of trending naturally down, well, maybe then you collect samples and you have high values in the early phase, which might be your background period, and lower values later on, and that may not be reflective of whether or not there's a release. So it's important to look at your data and to look at things like stability of your background, whether it's, you know, over time or over space. The other applications, release detection, you know, are concentrations steadily increasing? You might be wondering about that. In terms of looking at compliance, we're looking at things like I already mentioned, monitored natural attenuation. So that's natural conditions, you know, or is there a natural decrease in concentrations? And we're going to talk about optimization quite a bit in the next segment, but, you know, is the sampling effort appropriate? And the question came about, you know, what is the appropriate sampling effort? And we'll talk about some tools where you can help to understand that in the next section of the training. Well, seasonality. So this, a couple of things we can do here. So this is study question six, and those are in Appendix C. If you're interested in seeing the study questions, or like Carol said, you can just link, you know, click to them directly from the web-based guidance document screen there, and you can get to that question. So, and also we have an Appendix A, and Appendix A has some examples of some of these methods in the web-based guidance document. So this is our example 8.2. And so again, the first thing we did was we plotted the data. So in this case, we have a data set that's changing pretty radically. So we can see that it's around 3 to something in 30-40 range here. So that's order of magnitude difference in concentration over time. And it's, you know, it's varying, you know, quite wildly. So we plotted the data. In this case, we chose a log scale. So this helps, I guess, somewhat with understanding what the distribution of data might be. Then we're going to do some testing. So one thing we might be looking at is, first of all, is there seasonality? You know, here we have sampling events, and they're quarterly events. So if we then just label one of the quarters, you can now see more clearly. So here's just the October samples, and you can kind of imagine there's a trend of just those. So it looks like if we just look at a particular event, well, actually, there's more of a trend that's apparent. There's a lot of variation here, but you know, what is the underlying pattern in the data. So this is one of the things you can do with the seasonality analysis. And so what we show on this plot is, again, so we have the data, and before I overlap, they're all detected values, and they're this raw data, unadjusted values here. Then we have what's called an adjusted value, and then we have the mean. And so when you're doing a time series analysis, one of the things, there's various methods for doing it. One of the things you can do is you can basically look at these data sets. In this case, the October data set is a distinct group, and we're going to have other sampling events in the other quarters. And they look and say, you know, what is the value we have on average in October? And then you can have a value, obviously, in January and April and July. So you'd have each of these values, and that's one level. And if you're familiar with statistical analyses, these are analysis of variance. You're looking at these as levels, say, okay, well, there's an effect of the season. We get different result in different seasons. And then what you can do is, using the overall mean and then these basically the values for each period, you can come up with an adjusted value. And the adjusted value has removed the seasonality. And so now that's the solid line here that's got a lot less variability in the middle. And so just to carry forward with this particular example, again, it's in A.2 in Appendix A. But now we've taken the data, and we're just showing the adjusted values. Now what's shown is the open circles here are the adjusted, which is the seasonality removed values. And there's quite a bit less range in these values, and the overall trend's a little more obvious, I think, when you remove the seasonality for this example. And here we've just shown two different methods. We had a question came about whether or not we use linear parametric or non-parametric. So the Thielsen line, and then the associated slope would be the Thielsen slope estimator. In this case, because the data are log normally distributed, so it's really a linear regression on the logs, you know, these two methods actually come out with the same results. But we just show this for illustration. It kind of indicates, in some sense, the robustness of the result. But if you were, like I was saying, laying out an analysis plan, you would say, well, if the data are normal or can be transferred to normality, I'm going to use a parametric method. So I would use the linear regression if I was doing this for an actual site. Okay, what about another application of trend analysis? So here we're looking at contaminant attenuation rate. In this particular application, we're saying, yeah, let's look at how we can look at the trend, the overall trend we're seeing in the data set, and then include the confidence band and be able to use this to test the criterion to indicate whether or not we're in compliance now, or whether or not we've attained our cleanup goals. So this is an example with TCE. In this particular example, we're just saying that these are all detected values of TCE. And then we have a couple other things on here besides the actual values. We have this is the Thielsen, so I guess we use the non-parametric method in this case. And then this method has a 90% confidence band around this model. And so what we're doing on the confidence band, again, so the confidence band is really within the data set. So we have a range of data, it's about 2.5 years of data collected here. And we have this model that we've fit, and this is basically we're, in essence, interpolating between these values. And so there's a couple different things we can do with this. So we can just say, oh, well, here's the first point where we're below the criterion. But then again, that's without any, confidence in this overall relationship that gives us that information. But we might be more interested in saying, yeah, we actually within this range, now this at this point, where the confidence bound on this Thielsen line has attained compliance with this cleanup goal. So we can say with 90% confidence that we have attained the cleanup goal based on this attenuation rate and confidence bound on the attenuation rate. Okay, well, what about another example? Now, this one is actually similar in lots of ways, but quite different. So what we're looking at is the same example from Appendix 8.2. So it's that same data set that we had. And we're just showing here the transformed data or the adjusted data, not just the raw observations. And so we have, this cloud of data, centered around this point. And then we're going to want to look out into the future. And so when we're looking outside of the envelope or data, this is extrapolation. So it's an area where we don't have any measured data, but we like to make a prediction about what's going to happen in the future. So if you think about it, when you see things like, hurricane forecasts, they make a prediction. And, when you look at predicting out, in the next day or two, the bounds around that are very small. And then we look out further, the bounds increase. And here functionally we have something similar, although this is a very simple model. What we have is basically a model we fit. So again, thinking about the interpolated part, we have a model and a best estimate of the slope within this range here. But, there's a confidence bound on that slope. The slope might have been a little bit shallower, or it might have been a little bit steeper, given even these data. So we have some uncertainty, in essence. The confidence in that slope is what it is. So we have, it could be a little bit higher, a little bit lower. And that's when then extrapolating out, if the slope's a little bit higher, then, well, you can optimistically attain the cleanup goal, by about 2030. And then we look at 2020, I'm sorry. And then if you look out further, then it's after 2060 when, you know, the more worst case. And so this is, in essence, gives us a bounds on when we might be attaining this, this cleanup goal in the future. So again, the main point here is we're extrapolating out, and so there's more uncertainty when we extrapolate out into the future. Okay, well, let's turn to our last topical area. So it's monitoring optimization. And we have a couple of study questions associated with that. And so one question has to do with the basically the sampling frequency. Is the sampling frequency adequate to make make decisions? And is the spatial coverage, so the number of wells, locations we have, adequate for understanding whatever question we're trying to ask about that plume? So, and then basically when we're looking at optimization, we're trying to, have, an efficient data collection program. As I indicated under, when we're talking about power and analysis, that in some sense you always have more information with more data. But there can be a point of kind of diminishing returns. You really don't get much of a different answer by collecting incrementally that next sample or adding another well. You already have a lot of information there. And the problem is, in most cases, there's a trade-off. There's a certain amount of time or budget. And so you can't collect an infinite number of samples to address your problem. You have to figure out some way of collecting the right amount of data for the decisions you're trying to make. And then when we're looking at this in terms of statistical design parameters, we're trying to eliminate the correlation or redundancy in the results and make sure that, again, the data are adequate for accurate decisions. And this is given our conceptual site model and also the alpha and beta we're trying to occur to get. Okay, well, oh, one other thing I forgot to mention there was there's also a team that's in the, if you go to the ITRC webpage, it's in the related area, but it's the Geostatistics Remediation Optimization, and they have their web-based guidance document out, and they also have training. And so if you're interested in that, I refer you to the ITRC webpage to look for when training's coming up. I think they have training coming up next month. Okay, well, question came up about time series and adequate numbers of samples already. But when you're looking at temporal optimization, then it is the question, we want to have an optimal frequency of samples. So one of the main issues that can happen is that you can have redundant samples. And this will be different for different kinds of groundwater, characteristics and plumes. So you have to kind of look at your data and look at the conceptual model. But the main question is whether or not when you collect a sample, you basically get basically the same result over multiple events, in which case they're adding very little value to understanding the time trend in that particular analyte in that well. So what you'd want to do is adjust the frequency so that you don't have such of a correlation or such redundancy, but still capture overall trends in the data set. Well, there's a number of ways you could do this. You could imagine that, you could do this kind of manually. You could say, I could take my data set and I can take and remove these samples, and then I can rerun the analysis and see what I get, see if I get the same result. Well, luckily, there's some methods out there, some software. And this is an example using a visual sample plan. So, again, this is highlighting another one of the examples we have in Appendix A. So this is A.4. So this is an example. We worked up with a couple different data sets, and I chose this one for a particular reason. I'll talk about here in a second. But overall, what the process starts doing is it looks at your data set, and it has, here's the values. So it's these black circles are the actual data, and then it's going to be fitting a smooth data set to that. And that's what these values are here, these filled circles are that I'm highlighting there. That's what you get. And then the other thing that you have is, again, with a statistical method, you have a 90% confidence interval around that smooth line. So the objective of iterative thinning is to say, can I take out half the samples, 90% of the samples, and still capture this trend with the desired level of confidence? And this particular example, with the way we set this up in the visual sampling plan, the solution it gave was 227 days. So that's roughly, you know, two samples per year. It's a little bit less than that, but conveniently you just probably pick one every 6 months, and that would capture that trend. So what I want to point out is when you're doing this kind of approach, there's some things to be aware of. So there's always a model. So here's the model and the fit, and saying how well we fit that model. In this case, there's also these points now down here that I'm highlighting by circling around them. So those points down there are, in essence, what we think about statistics is the lack of fit of the model. Now, in this case, those values are below this overall trend. And so maybe points that are below, we're not so concerned about missing potentially some of those, but that's if we collect fewer samples, now there's a chance that we might miss some of those. But maybe we're not so worried about those points. But it's something to be aware of is that whenever you're constructing a model and you're looking at how well you can recreate the model, you have to think about, well, how well is the model actually, you know, predicting the data? So there's always the question about the lack of fit. Okay, well, here's another approach, also based on another software package that's available. And so this is out of Meros, which is the Monitoring and Remediation Optimization System. And so I'll just walk you kind of through this. So basically this is a method that's going to do, based on some statistical analyses of your data set, you'll come up with a basically a recommended program. And in this case, they're looking at quarterly, semi-annual, and annual as kind of what you might have. So quarterly is the most intensive sampling that this chart recommends. So this chart is basically saying, well, we're going to have these different levels of sampling, quarterly to annual. And we're going to look at two different things. We're going to look at the results of the rate of change from linear regression. So the rate of change, in this case, if it's high, you set up in the software a standard or MCL or some other kind of target. And that's high means you're going at two times that value. So it's quite a high rate of change. Low is less than half, and medium is in between the two. And that's what you can see if you look at these columns. That's the main thing that's affecting the number of the frequency of sampling that Meros is going to recommend. And then in finding that, there's the Mann-Kendall trend, and then whether or not the trend is increasing or decreasing modifies to some extent whether or not you do, you know, quarterly or you know, semi-annual. So you can see that if you have a high rate of change, but it's a decreasing trend, well, we're not so worried about capturing that every quarter. You know, semi-annual might be okay. So that's basically how that that software works in terms of recommending a number of samples per well. Okay, well, spatial optimization. So spatial optimization is, in some sense, you know, a fair amount more complex kind of activity. And as I indicated, there's actually a whole other group that's dealing with a lot of spatial issues. But, you know, this will give you some flavor for, you know, what some of the tools are out there and what you can do with them. So in general, though, I mean, the goal is pretty straightforward. I mean, you have you know, a network of wells, and we have wells where we have existing samples, and then you can ask the question pretty directly, you know, is this well giving me basically the same information as neighboring wells or not? And of course, where you don't have wells, you don't have any information. And so you have to have some sort of model to predict, you know, what is the uncertainty there. And there's a lot of different tools for doing that. But basically, you could do this again by hand. It'd be very laborious. You could remove wells, groups of wells, and look at what happens to estimates of, you know, whatever, you know, mass of the contaminant or whatever trend you're trying to evaluate. And then you can also potentially locate areas where you have, you know, a few wells. That's obviously inherently an uncertainty, and is it really an uncertainty depends on your conceptual model. So if we look at, you know, some of the different approaches here for doing, you know, spatial analyses, you know, this slide is illustrating a couple different things. So it's just here listing, you know, some of the tools we have out there for evaluating spatial redundancy, whether or not you can remove wells, or potentially some of these methods work for helping to add wells. So we mentioned, you know, genetic algorithms, and this isn't having anything to do with biology, but there's a set of computer programming tools that are basically related to those, where it's basically going out and trying to find a more optimal solution. Now, you can imagine if you have a fairly large network, there would be a large number of combinations of wells you might add or remove. And so that's what the genetic algorithms do, is they help try to locate what these are. And GTS Smart is a particular tool that uses some of those. And there's other things, slope factors, relative errors, that's something that Merrows uses. There's kriging, which is a kind of geostatistical analysis. And, of course, then there's a more qualitative evaluation. If you have a fairly small site, it might be relatively straightforward, to do a more qualitative assessment. And then the other thing here, the reason why I like showing this particular diagram, is not that you need to worry about how what the definitions are of the Voronoi and the Delaney triangles and how you do interpolation, but those are nice, but what's important actually is actually considering an edge. In this particular case, if we have the central location is this well, N0, and it's got wells all around it. Now imagine one or more of these on the outside are actually, there's no other wells, further away. So that's an edge. So this is something that's pretty important in spatial analysis to understand edges. Sometimes they're based on a physical property, and you can handle them, in a particular way there. But if it's really an edge and it's, an uncertainty, then that has to be handled differently. You don't have as much data, and so you might get a misinterpretation of, what the concentrations or uncertainty are if you just let the data be, if you just run some of these methods without accounting for that specifically. Well, just to highlight another tool. So this is the Geostatistical Temporal Spatial Software, so GTS. And we have a little information in Appendix D. So this example just is showing, what you might be setting up in this software. In this case, we only have, a fair number of locations with, wells with data. And that's what these, pluses are, green pluses are. And there's a variety of locations. There's not just one over here. There's a lot there. And then what's shown here is now, statistical estimate of the uncertainty. And that's what these circles are. So the circles are, small circle is low uncertainty, and then the high, large circle like we have down here is high uncertainty. And then you might see in some cases we have more than one circle in a location. And it means that this software actually is looking at more than one type of contaminant. And so it's giving us information that, one contaminant's got a pretty low uncertainty, another one's got a little more moderate uncertainty. But what's pretty clear is that there's a lot of wells here, and then these are pretty small circles, so they're basically down at the minimum. So these are areas where you have, probably an excess of information, the same thing over here. You can also look at this qualitatively and say, here's, a location where we have, high uncertainty, at least for some contaminants, and very little well coverage. So that'd be an area where you would be looking at potentially adding wells. So, that's what I thought was kind of neat about that approach. Well, as I already alluded to, there's, you could do some of this actually manually, but it'd be quite cumbersome and time-consuming. Luckily, there's software tools to help you look at some of this. And in this case, you can look in Appendix D and get some reviews of what some of these tools can do and the complexity of problems they can handle. The GTS can actually look at this temporal spatial optimization kind of jointly. Some of their tools just look at one or the other of the, whether you're doing spatial or temporal optimization. So I think with that, I'll turn the presentation back over to Harold to wrap things up. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Randall. And so carry on with the concluding our training here. I'd like to go over three specific areas of the document that, once again, reiterating their importance to understanding the statistical methods that we're talking about. In Section 5, if you were on the welcome page and you click statistical method, you come to this Section 5, and we have the different statistical methods grouped together based upon their application, such as trends. They're all in 5.5. And with this, you might, you might click on the trends, and it would take you to the different trends that are listed. And with that, it gives you references in the Unified Guide where you'd find out about that. It would tell you the application and the study questions that are, it's linked to, the assumptions that you need, and strengths and weaknesses. Once again, reiterating that this document is not a how-to, but a resource to go find how-to if you want to on how to use the method, how you calculate the method. Then next, as Randall was talking about, this Appendix D is a list of software packages that the team reviewed. The team back in 2011 or 12 surveyed a group, sent out a survey trying to find out the most widely used software packages for statistical analysis. And they came up with these 23 different packages, which are commonly used. When you go out and you might use this, you need to be certain that you understand its limitations and its purpose for use, and because many of these software packages may not be specific to environmental sampling, such as Excel, which is just a data management package. And we, once again, we would point out that you could pick out a software package. It would take you to that software and telling you its approximate cost, operating system requirements, ease of use, its capabilities, the benefits, and references, where you can find out more about this software package. Under the limitations, the team put together this capability table, and within it, there we would take a software package that I took a screenshot here of one software package, and specific to how it handles non-detects. So it has full capability, as shown by the filled-in circle, for simple substitution. If you want to substitute one specific value for all the non-detect values, then it can do that for you. At the time of our putting the package together, Kaplan-Meier and ROS were not able to be used by this software package, and there was limited capability for the Cohen method. With the web-based document, you can come directly to this. On your welcome page, you can click on software, and you can come directly to this these pages and pick out our suggested use for the software what the software package can be used for. Also, one last thing I wanted to talk about was the groundwater, your management of the data. Remember back at the beginning where we first came in with the drowning in our groundwater data at our desk. So when you first start out, you should plan out how you're going to manage your data. Many sites, many laboratories now, if not all, have an electronic data deliverable format. And you can set up your format to so that the data that comes from the laboratory can easily fit into your database and streamline your analysis of the data. As the groundwater data comes in, you should have a strategy for handling it, and by following the outline in Section 6, you'll be able to streamline your analysis of the data and provide a basic system for handling that data consistently and efficiently. In summary of our training, I want to point out how that Randall at first presented information on applying the statistical approach. And from that, we hope that you become more confident in handling the statistical concepts, better able to select the appropriate statistical method for your project, and the appropriate software tools that might be used at your project. Then, in the training, Liz and Randall explained the application of the study question to site-specific activities, such as background, understanding compliance, implementing trend analysis, and the optimization, monitoring optimization. These were four key areas of the training, but the guidance document provides user-friendly explanations for other areas of statistics for evaluating your groundwater data. And with that, let me recommend that you go to the listed URL there and or to the link here in our presentation and allow the web-based document to guide you into using appropriate statistical methods to address common project tasks and make better decisions for your project. As we show here, the welcome page and the way to go through the different avenues of picking out what you would want to do for the better decision on your project. But in any case, make sure that this document becomes part of your toolbox for managing groundwater data. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Juliana.
Thank you, Harold. We are going to have a little bit of time for your questions. You're welcome to send those in using that Q&A pod in the lower right. I have a final couple of poll questions to ask our presenters. We're wrapping up today. On our slide, we have a link to the additional resources. This is where you can go to download the presentation and also see many of the links that we talked about during today's class, including the guidance document that's the basis of today's training. I'd also like to ask you to fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide, not only for this class, but we also develop new courses, and we can use your information to help improve those courses. That feedback form is also your path to create a participation certificate for yourself. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended. If you forget to check it, just go back, check the box, and submit again, because that's how our system creates the certificate, is once you check that box. And on the next page, you can view your certificate of participation. It's a PDF. It's also emailed to you. We'll get to as many questions as we can that have come in. How do you deal with discrepancies in the sampling efforts? For example, upgradient wells are sampled once a year, and downgradient wells are sampled quarterly. This is from data that has already been collected and handed to you. You had no influence on the study design.
Yeah, that's I'm sure there's lots of different exceptions that come up, in general, that would be considered to be an issue with them being not comparable on some level. It might be that you could still run the statistical analyses. And one of the things I think we didn't talk about today in detail was the concept of independently and identically distributed. So what that means is basically there's a lack of temporal or spatial correlation among the values. So, the fact that you have half as much data, time series-wise, with your background might be okay, but I think I would just tend to want to look at, the distribution of the data, look for what you can in terms of time and space trends, and then do what you can. You can run the analyses but there might be some caveats associated with the results of statistical comparisons when, the data sets have some fundamental, difference without, unless there's some apparent, explained reason for why you'd be doing that.
If you had diurnal, seasonal, and tidal control fluctuations, how would you address?
Oh, that'd be an interesting site to be working with. I guess, it's getting down to, what of all those things which are varying over very different timescales, what's the main factor influencing concentrations that you're concerned about? And then you might even have to look at, if you have a standard or something that you're trying to comply with, you might be more concerned about, somewhat chronic exposures, and so those small timescale, changes may not be as important. On the other hand, they could be. So I think it has to get back to, like I said, to talk about your objectives. So what are you trying to compare to, and why? And you would have to understand that first of all, And then certainly there are methods, for understanding, for basically taking, complex time series data, and you can have, trends like that, or, periodicity on something other than just seasonal, and you can evaluate that, and you can remove that potentially. So, and you can also, it can also help to inform, maybe when you might sample. I know I've worked on cases where you're in streams, where you're looking at, things that change, diurnally, like DO, and you might be trying to just get comparable data. But it really gets back to specifics about, what kind of contaminants and, what's the conceptual model for the site, that kind of thing.
Thank you. We are out of time for today's training class. If you submitted a question and we weren't able to get to it, please let us know. You can email me at training@itrcweb.org. We can post that question and ask the trainers to follow up after the class. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you haven't already, please fill out that feedback form. We really do use the information and appreciate you giving us your feedback. More information about ITRC is available on the website, www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.